This little discussion is entitled The Unspoken Language of Worship. I come at this as an architect and a person who's been involved in worship efforts, I guess, for quite some time, starting when I was a Luther Leaguer. And at St. Olaf College, I was part of the student congregation and put on with others some interesting celebrations, one being a fantastic Easter when everyone was on campus and we had processions from end of campus to end of campus and everybody had a remarkable time. And recently I've been involved with worship and planning and the board of Worship, Music, and Arts at St. John's Parish in Northfield, besides working on church designs. And I'm suggesting that as sort of the kickoff of this week's series on looking at different dimensions of worship, that we start by thinking about what I like to call the unspoken language of worship. And the way to get at that, I believe, is to kind of look at it indirectly together, rather than being filled immediately with looking at this from the perspective of a lot of definitions. It's partly an excuse because I'm not trained theologically or in many other disciplines, so I have to kind of take an indirect route, I guess, to get at this subject. But it, in part, is derived from the fact that there's some phenomena about worship that we all, I think, can look at as participants or as objective observers that provoke, I think, some interesting questions, like, why is it that it appears that the evangelical and Pentecostal types of churches, which don't have a very strong, let's say, liturgical background, why do they seem to be gaining more members than Lutherans and Episcopalians and Presbyterians? And there's something about their worship that keys people into what they're doing better than what most of us are doing. We might also ask questions about, well, why in seminaries does it appear that matters of worship are treated kind of, I think, as practical courses? I've never been in seminary myself, but I hear from people who have that it really doesn't seem to be at the core, maybe until recently, or except maybe one or two seminary of the training.
The Lord will speak.
Another phenomena is that in reading some materials from the World Council of Churches, there, for instance, the Lima Statement that many of you have gone through, there's kind of a declaration that more and more churches worldwide are beginning to use some of the same forms of worship that historically have been used for centuries, albeit flavored and colored by the local culture, etc. So part of this talk is for us to just examine together what's really going on here in the way we do worship. And I guess like artists are prone to do, what I'm asking for us to consider is to kind of get outside of ourselves, to look at the phenomena of a group of people assembling on Sundays or other times and saying, well, what happens? What's the medium of exchange? What kind of communication is going on? What is the what is this event in terms of really the medium of communication? One way we could get at this, I've always thought, is maybe we could poll people. In fact, I think it would be interesting to poll children and say, that's because I got little kids, I guess, but and have them simply write down, what do people do at worship? And see what lists they put together. Because I suspect that really the actions and the perceptions about those actions, because they might be devoid of some of the deeper meanings, might in themselves be instructive. You know, people sit, people stand, that pass the offering plate. There's a long period where you have to sit still and it's boring, or other such statements. That would be interesting, and I think what it simply points to is that we might find something out about the medium itself by doing that kind of questioning among ourselves. And I guess I want to base this on some other awarenesses we have about communications that are part of our culture now, that maybe we have to become more sophisticated about and learn about, because since Marshall McLuhan wrote his books in the 1960s, and since then, I think we are keyed in to the fact that a lot of communication takes place that is extraverbal. And I would like to posit that this is a very important part of our worship enterprise together. In that respect, I want to say this in a non-political way, really. It's amazing to me that we've gone through the last presidency where we've had the great communicator as president, who has been documented, I think, by the media observers as the kind of a role on television in which what is said, in fact, does not matter. It's the way it's said. If people feel good and feel like the country is being led and all that, really the text, whether the text squares with what was said a year ago or 2 years ago or whatever, it really, really is irrelevant. On purpose, according to the media planners of some of the press conferences and things of that sort. And that's an interesting thing in itself, the way we, as a culture, are responding to the television and other media and absorb one kind of content to the exclusion of another, perhaps. And there might be some relevance to the way we think about the way we behave in worship similarly. We might learn some things from theater. And one reason for the three of us to be promoting this three-ring circus this week is that there are issues about movement and blocking and lighting and color and sound and all these kind of, I don't want to call it this, but these staging principles that do have an effect on the way this thing we call worship takes place. We're also trained to a great degree, I think, more and more by kind of the rapid pace and the juxtaposition of images and the kind of the visual excitement of commercials and film. Very, very highly sophisticated, highly paced material that is part of our regular diet. And that, no doubt, subliminally becomes a part of the context in which we go to church, because we're going to an event and we may have just been part of another scene that had a lot more happening. There's a whole another kind of pace, a lot more engaging than when we sit in church. What are we to do about that as people who plan worship services or plan environments for worship? Another phenomenon that is I think part of this mix is that in some ways our world seems to be more and more defined by mathematics to many people than it is by stories and words and verbal linkages of things. We are understanding space and economic models. And a lot of phenomena are modeled in a whole different language than the one we use for speech concepts at this point. Now, the hunch I'm playing on here that I guess would be the thesis for the rest of this session tonight, and the way I'd like to organize this discussion about this thesis is that we talk for a little while longer, and there'll be an opportunity to do a little bit of sharing. And then perhaps at maybe 7:45 or 7:50, another 20 minutes. We go until 8:15, is that right?
Or 8:30.
Or 8:30, okay. We'll take a quick stretcher break so I can refocus the projector, and then I'll show some slide examples of things. The thesis that I'm getting to is simply the notion that these non-spoken components of this language really are more powerful than we want to admit or want to work with. They really have a great effect on us in the worship setting and worship environment, and we better learn about them. And one way to start thinking about them is really to deal with our senses, because our senses are the way we engage the world around us, the way we interact with other people, etc. And rather than dealing with things that are more abstract than that initially, because I'm not capable of talking about these things as well. So I think we should take a quick tour kind of how our senses operate, and this will, I think, be supplemented throughout the week by what you folks have to contribute for sure, because I mostly deal with visual sensations and illusions, visual tricks, and you folks deal with other realities much better than I would. But I think this unspoken language is such a powerful force. We have to pay attention to it more and more. Similarly, I think perhaps culturally we all are trained almost to the postgraduate degree level in verbal issues, but most of us have really hardly started grade school when it comes to dealing with these other phenomena. We're just really quite ignorant about how these things work, and we have to do a lot of catching up, I believe. That's one reason I'm interested in it. I feel like I've got to do a lot of catching up. I'm not understanding these things very fully at all at the current moment. And so the place to start is, I guess, our senses. We want to try to do this in a way in which we think about senses as a kind of holistic combination of mind-body functions, rather than thinking of it at just a conceptual level, or thinking, because we know that physiologically any one of the senses that we talk about, first of all, involves a physiological device or part of our body that we touch with our skin, we look with our eyes, etc., and our brain is involved in that process. But the second phenomenon is that I think we all realize that we use our senses together. You know, we use senses not one at a time. We use them in combinations. And that's why we've become so interested, I think, in the last 20 years in things like nonverbal communication that goes along with hearing words. Those who are deaf need to look at people while they're speaking, because it helps fill in the meaning of the language to them. Now, if we take a quick review of some of these issues, we'll emphasize more of these as we go on during the week. Hearing. Hearing is incredibly central to language and our sense of putting together concepts and basic raw thinking, and obviously is a very important part of how we deal with sounds and speech. There's no doubt about that. I'm not trying to minimize it. Sight and hearing together function very intimately. And just as I was saying, the interest in, let's say, in body language and nonverbal communication arises out of the fact that we put sight and statement, we put a lot of data together at one time, using those two senses together. An example of this is all of our kind of bias about or our orientation towards seeing is believing. And you have to see something to believe it, because that's really part of your sense of reality. Or most of our senses of reality is you see something. The step beyond that usually is you want to touch it, to even gain a little bit more data, to say, well, is it there or is it not? And I want to be sure that my eyes aren't being tricked by something that you can only see but you can't feel. We talk about first impressions, which usually have to do with visual clues we pick up from a situation or from other people. And the first words someone might utter in a statement give very significant clues about that person. Is he a wimp? Or is this really a strong person? Is this someone who seems friendly and approachable? Is this a person who... We pick up on a lot of clues very quickly about people to form first impressions. And most of us try to hold those back a little bit and say, well, I'm going to wait a while before I make a final assessment on these things. And I would suppose I could learn a lot about this from this community, because you probably spent a lot of time talking about these personal interactions, because you all live so closely together here. Next is, of course, I think touch and feeling. As I said before, beyond seeing something, we really use touch to feel like something is real, to deal with any kind of doubts. The physiology of this, I think, is pretty evident to all of us, but it's a start at our thinking about how environments need to be organized to serve people, because basically our interface with our environment, our skin, first of all, is interested in issues of like temperature. Is it too warm? Is it too cold? We use clothing for that purpose, but our spatial environments are an extension of that skin, so to speak, of being the mediator between weather and climate and our outer environment, and the fact that our sense of touch is affected by temperature. Wetness is another one, of course, that is very obvious to anyone. Texture is something that we have a lot of sensitivity to in terms of touch, whether something is smooth, rough, prickly. Lots of, just a zillion combinations of those sensations, when you think about it, are picked up very subtly by a sense of touch, usually reinforced by sight, sometimes by sound. You know, if something feels wet and you hear running water, it kind of confirms it perhaps, well, yeah, that probably is wet stuff. Things that might cause pain are kind of another reality that certainly deals a lot more with the brain maybe than just the skin, unless it's a cut or a pin you sit on or something of that sort that creates a direct reaction. Now, one thing that I hope we spend a lot of time talking about is the whole area of touching, which is a very sensuous relationship we have with others and with loved ones and with the world. And it's becoming, I think, more and more part of our commercial culture, the fact that we realize that that this is such an incredibly central function in life, just the issue of touching. AT&T has coined a clever phrase. What is it called? And how do you do that over the telephone? Interestingly enough, you can feel in touch over the telephone because of the way we use our senses together, or the way it evokes memories, things of that sort. We talk about getting in touch with ourselves or relatives, or lots of cliche things we can think about. I suppose most important for all of us is that touching is one of the basic communications of affection, love, acceptance. Because what is the opposite of that? When there's no touching going on between people. What is that? What does that usually communicate to people?
Deprivation.
Distance.
Distance.
Isolation. Coolness.
Alienation.
Simple thing, right? Simple reality here. If you are an untouchable, if you take it that far, who are you?
An outsider.
You might be diseased, you might be shunned.
Not likable.
And so keeping in touch as an issue is something we could think a lot about, perhaps as part of the syntax of this hidden language, because if we are interested in, for instance, any kind of community building, perhaps the way people can deal with each other with these physical sensations might really enhance, give people permission to be more in touch with each other, even if it doesn't involve grabbing and hugging them. But it might. And I think that's an interesting subject for us to spend some more productive time on. Another one, of course, is the sensations that go along with taste and smell. Kind of put those two together. We are active in worship, of course, with a meal, which is very basic. We frequently deal with concepts that become very kind of abstract about religious odors, incense, which we talked about tonight already, that permeate, prayers permeate the whole group like incense. But I think studies on animal behavior, and we are, after all, also animals, that smells are really very strong. We might want to say primitive, but that carries with it kind of some judgmental qualifiers. Smells are very strongly endowed features of our existence. We react very strongly to bad odors, good odors. We can leave it at that. We're a little afraid of some of those issues, I think, in the church environment, how we might deal with issues of smell. And we, of course, sometimes we mask body smells by the way we want the environment to be to kind of deal with a better way, or by kind of having an absolution of covering everyone, whether it's the smell of candles or whether it's the smell of pine boughs or whatever. But it's there, it's part of our being. And I think it's one of the components that we need to really concentrate on, understanding, even if we don't make a lot of use of it. Now, I thought we could go into some examples and start having a little bit more discussion about, before I show slides, about some types of situations, let's call them, especially in our church environment, where we really use our senses together. We have motions or actions or activities in which the message is carried by the way in which something happens, as much as or more than carried by language or words. We already, I think, know that, let's say when a pastor or a leader comes in front of the congregation and is kind of in the spotlight, that simply the way that person moves around begins to say something to people, right? There's kind of a hidden rule book, I suppose, about the way someone behaves up front. I've never seen this written down anywhere, but usually you don't see pastors running around in the chancel. You usually see a certain amount of decorum, a certain kind of seriousness about what they're doing. It's kind of an unstated role. That's the way you behave up front. It's there. Whether it's good or bad, that's not what we're going to go into at this point. So the materials of this language then have to do with time, movement, posture, those elements. Not what's that? Kind of tying into the whole issue of body language in this illustration. To carry that one step further about movement, and our master on movement over here can fill this in during the week even more. I'm very conscious when I'm in church of the way people, let's say in a chancel, simply walk from place to place and their timing. I come out of a background where I'm around a lot of people who like to criticize liturgically oriented worship planners because they complain about the chancel prancers. And I'm not sure what that means exactly, except usually people who be accused of being chancel prancers are those who really plan exactly where they're going to be at a certain time, and there's kind of an orderly sense of where someone is going from point to point. I find a certain nervousness and anxiousness when I'm sitting in a pew and in a way nothing is happening up front, or I'm waiting for somebody to walk from over here solemnly, not doing it too quickly because I don't want to be so too much on the spot, and then they begin the next event on the service. There's a certain built-in formality about what happens in chancels by those people who are trying not to be formal that is very deadening and very much a loss of time and loses people's attention. And I'm almost convinced that when that happens, perhaps that preacher or that leader or something, if they're not thought about it, that's one thing, if they're a person who's just going up to read something. But whether or not they've thought about this, one could say that maybe the message is that that person really likes to be in the limelight. That person does. Because after all, everybody's looking at them. Not interested maybe in the way the flow of the surface works or the way in which the music is going to follow on a song or whatever. But in fact, I want people to watch me walk around because I'm an important person in this. I'm a leader in this. Could that be the truth? I don't know. That would be an awful thing to say to somebody, to their face, wouldn't it? That you get a kick out of walking around up in the front because all the eyes are on you. We can get follow spots. Okay. And that would be very noticeable. Or if you videotape services and work the camera, you begin to notice some of these things too, which I've done. Another one that maybe is a little bit more interesting that I hope we deal with this week in more detail, and that is that what is our expressed meaning in the way we find different postures for praying? How do most of you at the moment in church pray? Is the mode out here to mostly sit and pray, or kneel, or stand up and stretch your arms? Or what's the general mode of prayer in the Northwest?
Sit.
Okay. What's the general mode of maybe prayer at communion or going to communion in the Northwest? Is that? Do most people kneel at communion or stand or sit in their pews? Or? Depends upon, I guess, the type of denomination it is. But
yeah. That's more of a say on it than Northwest. Or
pardon?
What type of denomination you would go to would have more of a say on that rather than Northwest.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about kneeling. In the churches I've been part of, that isn't associated a lot with with prayer, except at special occasions, maybe at a wedding, or when you're at communion, which isn't really prayer, but sort of is. And it'd be interesting if we had maybe someone here who is a good biblical scholar give us a little talk on what were the different postures in the Old Testament, the New Testament, when praying is happening? How did people talk to God in the Bible? And some of our interest in this phenomena, you could say that the current, I suppose, tradition of kneeling really didn't start out in the early church. It started out basically in about the 10th century, as far as we can tell. I think it was during the time of the Crusades. I think it was Charles I in France. I'm not sure if that's the right ruler, who, when France was Christianized, was very sensitive to the issue of, well, how should people in the congregation greet the Lord in prayer and communion? And the analogy that was used is, well, how would people greet a king? After all, this is the king. And of course, you would kneel. It made a lot of sense as the colloquial expression of more than respect of the king or the Lord. Today, what does kneeling in the world outside the church connote? In what cases do people kneel out in the world?
Scrub floors.
Yeah. Most of us don't, very much, right?
Kneel to take care of children. Some women will do that.
In some respects, I think in our culture today, it might connote a subservient role. Mm-hmm. But you're somehow below someone else, mm-hmm, if you kneel to them, which is tied to that older expression. If the President of the United States walked into the room right now, what would we do?
Stand up.
We wouldn't kneel?
Mm-mm.
I don't think we would.
Mm-mm.
Now, if we follow Charles I's logic, that if in worship we should pay the same respect to God and the Lord as we would to that relationship on earth, what would be our best posture for prayer, for taking communion? It probably would be standing, if we follow that logic. And some congregations, I think, are really experimenting very successfully with some of these ideas of trying to connect, make very clear statements about body posture and what that means. That's the point of this discussion about those kinds of language. Another one, and then we'll finish up this session, has to do with touching. We do a very little touching in church these days. We're kind of scared of that. I am, anyway. Kind of trained to be that way, being a kind of a crusty Scandinavian from a Swedish Lutheran background, not a Norwegian Lutheran background, but I live in a Norwegian Lutheran town, and things are quite similar in that respect. Where in the service have we now begun to touch each other as parishioners or worshipers?
Passing
the peace. That's been introduced fairly recently, from an old tradition in the church. Actually, I think under Paul's instructions that there should be the kiss of peace. At that time, actually, people kissed each other. I think in one of his statements, he instructed the church to men should kiss men, and bishops should kiss bishops, and women should kiss women, and there was some concern, like in his writings to Corinth, about we don't want this to go too overboard, we don't want to have love feasts, and, you know, we don't want to go too far with this, because those who aren't initiated with faith are going to misconstrue what's going on in this ritual. But there's definitely a sense that sense with other people was incredibly important, at least at that level. And I guess symbolically, I'm not sure of what all the current theological thinking might be at this point, but obviously acceptance, the communication of love to one another, has to deal with reconciliation and forgiveness and that kind of statement to each other. In our church, we have a great deal of trouble with that action. It's really refreshing to come here where people spend a lot of time at the passing of the peace by really greeting each other and hugging each other and spending a little bit of time with each other. St. John's in Northfield, it's very stiff because there are those who don't even want to turn around in their pew. I can't quite understand it because we turn around to look at the bride, you know, in church. But that's a different setting where we can't turn around. It's very hard to do in St. John's. Okay, what are some of the other examples in which touch is part of our religious heritage? Can we just name a few really quickly? And we'll leave it at that. Take a break and we'll come back and look at some slides.
Baptism.
Mm-hmm. Laying on of hands.
Right, laying on of hands is since the very beginning, right? Any others?
Imposition of ashes, ash ones.
Washing of the feet.
In the New Testament, I'm reminded of the fact of how many healing incidents had to deal with touch. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jesus touched someone, mm-hmm. or asked them to reach out and touch him. And of course, maybe that has to do with a sensory situation of that culture, where touching someone who was special like Jesus maybe had some more magical qualities than we were willing to. If someone could even touch the hem of his garment, right? That action brought forth powerful changes. I think the learning about those things is pretty fundamental and easy to do. Most architects, for instance, are trained in that, or people who are interested in solar architecture. We have little charts that show us exactly what angle the sun is at any time, any day of the year, at any latitude. You can use models. Most of us in architecture school build models of spaces, and then you put them on a device called a heliodon, in which you move a light around like it's the sun, and then you examine what happens with the light. And if you're doing solar studies, you want to look at that from the dimension also of where light will fall, so it heat might be absorbed from it. When you want heat in the wintertime, for instance, or in the summer, you want to study where it falls to avoid too much heat. And most of us are trained in that. And it's really quite easy for anyone to learn. In churches, there's also the added element, in practical terms again, that you don't want to blast people with too much light. It's easy to overheat people or put light on their eyes a few days of the year so that they can't see what's going on. And the easiest way to avoid that is actually to use stained glass everywhere. Because that was an easy solution, if you can afford it, because it diffuses the light and avoids that problem. If you're using clear glass, it's actually harder to work with because you have to position windows and balance windows so that you cut out that kind of glare or direct sunlight on people's heads. And also, you need light, like in Hagia Sophia, you need light to come in and hit other surfaces so you know what the space is like. Just takes study. Now to go the next step and say, well, how do you use light really symbolically or so that this space is just a wonderful place, I think has to start with those practical things first. You don't start with, I'm going to put a hole in the roof and this is going to be light coming from heaven. you don't start there. I think if you start with things you call practical, which are the earthy issues, you're safer in the long run, because you might end up with a really more beautiful space in the end. Because, again, in an integrative sense of using our senses, you will, as an intelligent human being, will go into that space and you will say, ah, there's the sunlight, it works. You know, it's hitting the wall, it's providing light, I can feel the warmth, but it's not in my eyes. This is a nice space to be in. And that's a perfect example of how, in the end, we want to be able to integrate our central understanding of a space, so that you say, ah, this works, for many reasons. Long answer to a nice question.
You said that, I was thinking, this is to come into a place where there's, talking about light from above, where you're trying to make that, somebody's trying to tell you something that you should know, or ought to know. You come into a worship space, and this is a nice space to be in, as opposed to coming into a space, and you ought to be nice, maybe, because of what somebody's telling you you ought to do, maybe.
That you have to put on a certain kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. We call that, there's a price of admission to those kinds of spaces.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Do we have an antiphonal response?
The ballroom space, the light, that feels to me like a very extroverted kind of space. Not a space that I particularly want to go in and contemplate or go inside myself.
There's an interesting, when slides don't always represent spaces very well. What is interesting about that space, you should all, if you're ever in Denmark, northern Denmark, go to this place. Although castles and old buildings are often filled with parallels. But when you're there, you sense the massiveness of the walls, because you've been walking through these heavy castle walls, or and you go up these little stairways that are just rock. You know, you kind of wonder if you're going to get out. You know, it's so fortress-like. So you're really very aware of the material that's around you, the strength of these stone pillars. So seeing these little niches with light is kind of in a perfect balance with a sense of being protected and enclosed and contained in this heavy castle. And I think it's kind of neutral in that respect, in terms of how much you feel contained and shut out from the world, and how much it kind of opens itself to the outside, depending upon how you stand in the room.
I was thinking that your slide made it quite intriguing, because you knew that there were windows there that were causing that light to show, and it was like an invitation to come into those little niches and come closer to the light.
Exactly right. Again, light leading you in, inviting you.
Drawing you in. And it was drawing you in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different places. So it wasn't just for one person or for special people. It was for anybody that was around the room.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, it just made me recall that when I was there, I would go in one of those windows and look out the window, and then I wanted to go to another one. Uh-huh. And they're all the same. Why did I do that? One bank looks into the courtyard of the castle, and the other looks out on the sea, so I suppose that's the difference, but yeah, it's intriguing.